of getting some control. And I have years of being oppressed by the Sunni of the world and by the Baathists and by Saddam Hussein. I understand they're wanting to get some power in the country. I do understand that. I think it's very natural. But just some interesting things. I think tomorrow we may get a chance to talk about it. Just what happened between the Sunni and the Shia. So everybody bring your pencils and papers and notebooks tomorrow, and we'll hold a little class on that. Now, you could probably teach me a thing or two, but it's something we do need to discuss. And it's something I'm afraid the American government had no inkling, had no earthly idea about when this whole business started. I really don't think, I doubt whether George Bush had any clue as to the nature of the problem between the Shia and the Sunni before we went to war in Iraq. I would bet you money he didn't know the difference. I'm not saying everybody needs to know that, but I'm wondering why the leader of a country wouldn't before he would take us into war. I don't know why the Pentagon and everybody else wouldn't have a complete and total understanding of that and know what they were getting our soldiers into before some almost 3,400 of them now are killed, and this has been another disastrous week for American soldiers dying. It's unforgivable that this sort of thing would happen, that we would go headlong into a war and not have an understanding of what kind of a war we were getting in, have no knowledge of the language, the culture, and yet commit our troops to going door to door and dealing with people face to face and not knowing a damn thing about them. It's a pretty incredible situation, I think. And it's also pretty incredible that we had a government willing to throw us headlong into something like that. I don't think this nation ever should forgive the likes of George W. Bush and his administration for this horrible mess they've gotten us into. And make no mistake, it is a horrible mess. Well, another show gone by. I don't know where the time goes. We enjoyed your participation in the program. We thank you all for listening, the folks over at iTunes and Head On Radio Network and the various other websites that link up to the show. I want to thank you very much for doing that. We hope to talk to you again tomorrow, talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening. This is the Guy James Show and the Head On Radio Network. You've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. There's violence again in the Middle East. Well, that's not really a surprise. There's violence almost every week in the Middle East. Today, you can see it in Iraq with Shiites and Sunnis that are fighting each other in an incipient civil war. You can see it in northern Lebanon, where apparently the Hezbollah leader Nasrallah is going to defend the Palestinians in the refugee camp in northern Lebanon. Lebanon, of course, has declared war against Fatah al-Islam, a group that they call a terrorist group that's working out of that camp, has been known to rob banks and shell civilians. In southern Lebanon, Hezbollah is violating the United Nations Security Council resolutions to disarm and continuing its war against Israel. And, of course, in Gaza, Hamas is shooting missiles out. In fact, a woman was just killed in Sadr Road, an Israeli town, a 35-year-old woman. They continue to shoot the missiles after Israel's withdrawal. Israel has not withdrawn from the West Bank. Instead, it has built a security wall there. And there, at least, it is quiet. In my view, Israel needs to wait until it has someone opposing it who's willing to talk peace, who isn't trying to destroy it, and then I think Israel will withdraw from the occupation. But for a differing view, I've invited Josh Rubner. He is the grassroots advocacy coordinator with the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. Josh, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks so much for having me.
Josh, let me start with some basics so I can understand where we agree and where we disagree.
Sure.
And I understand that your organization is a coalition, so there may be many people in. So I'll ask for your personal views, and if you want to say where the organization, you know, believes, that's fine. But do you support the right of Israel to exist within secure and recognized boundaries as a Jewish state? I mean, are you a Zionist?
Well, what do you mean by exist as a Jewish state? With preferential treatment for its Jewish citizens?
Such as France has preferential treatment for French, America has preferential treatment for Americans, England has preferential treatment for the English. In other words, it wouldn't be an Arab state, it would be a Jewish state,
mm-hmm.
Basically Zionism. Now, I'm not talking about where the boundaries are. We may disagree on where the boundaries are. But do you support the right of Israel to exist?
Well, I support the right of all states to exist in peace and security. In terms of how Israel is composed and structured, I don't think that it's fair to have a state that has certain privileges for one religious group and doesn't have those same privileges for another group. So do I support Israel that discriminates between its Jewish and non-Jewish citizens? Absolutely not.
Okay, so you don't support the state of Saudi Arabia, for example, which discriminates against non-Muslims?
I have severe problems with Saudi Arabia's human rights record, absolutely.
And every state in Europe has a church. You would agree that every state in Europe should not have a state church?
Well, whether there's a state church or not is something very different from whether or not there's active discrimination based upon one's religion. Now, for example, inside Israel, a lot of social benefits accrue to having served in the army. Now, Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship and constitute 20% of Israel's population approximately, aren't entitled to those same social benefits.
Unless they agree to serve in the army, such as the Arab Druze and the Christians that do serve in Israel's army.
Well, there are very, very few Palestinian Israelis who serve in the army, and that's mainly because of the fact that they don't want to be put in a position where they have to oppress their brothers and sisters in the occupied Palestinian territories.
But there's some that do. The Bedouins do. The Druze do. There are. In fact, I was just in Israel a couple months ago and visited a Druze cemetery for all the people that have died in Israel's wars with the Arabs and saw the sacrifice they had made, and certainly they would have all the rights that accrue to anyone who's joined the army.
Yes, but you still have what's a very institutionalized form of discrimination because, for example, the Jewish National Fund owns the public land of the land of Israel. And the Jewish National Fund is a very discriminatory body that only leases and sells its land to Jews,
right,
discriminating against Israel's non-Jewish citizens. So, you know, the fact that you have land laws for Jews that are different from land laws for non-Jews is very problematic and very discriminatory.
Well, you say it's land laws. It's not the law. It's this Jewish National Fund.
It's the practice of the government of the state of Israel to discriminate in this way against its non-Jewish citizens in terms of land use, in terms of who's able to rent and own and develop land. And because Palestinian Israelis and Jewish Israelis, for the most part, live in separate communities, this actively allows the government of Israel to discriminate against Palestinian communities within Israel.
You're talking about Arab Israelis, right?
Yes, Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel, or Arab Israelis. But you have a gross inequality in terms of how the budget is allocated. So if you look at the education budgets, for example, between Jewish Israeli communities, Palestinian Arab communities, sometimes it's on the scale of 10 to 1 as a disadvantage to Israel's Palestinian citizens.
Now, in the United States, of course, we also have local payment for education. Illegal immigrants do not get the same education benefits that citizens do. And frankly, if you live in one part of Texas, you might not get the same as another part of Texas. We also have local control of education. Would you say that Israel provides more benefits to its Arab citizens than, say, Syria does to its Jewish citizens, or Egypt did, or Iraq did? I mean, clearly, Israel treats its Arabs better than the Arab countries treat their Jews.
Well, whether or not that's true, and I think you have to look at specific historic times to answer that question accurately, the point is that no state should be discriminating against its citizens based on their religion. So if another country does it, that certainly doesn't give Israel permission.
No, I agree. I think Israel should treat all its citizens equally. What I do think, though, is it has a right to prefer in immigration, just as Americans, I think you probably know, Ted Kennedy passed a bill through the Senate, where if you're of Irish ancestry, they get first priority. I mean, there's all kinds of very complex nationality. Certainly a state has the right to decide who immigrates to that state. You'd agree?
Oh, absolutely. States have the right to control their immigration policies. But when it comes to Israel's law of return for Jewish citizens, which allows Jews anywhere worldwide to claim citizenship upon arrival in Israel, this is also another very discriminatory aspect of Israeli policy.
Because why is that discriminatory?
You have in Israel's founding in 1948 a vast campaign of ethnic cleansing that pushed...
Whoa, ethnic cleansing?
Well, I'm not saying anything different than the most professional of Israel's historians when they talk about the 1948 war. What you have is a situation where the UN allocated to the Jewish state that was carved out of Mandate Palestine.
Out of Western Palestine.
Right. About roughly equal proportions of Jews and Palestinians within this proposed state. Now,
Jews and Arabs. I mean, to be fair, the Palestine Post became the Jerusalem Post. You're talking about the Jews and Arabs of Mandatory Palestine.
Yes, the Palestinian Arabs.
Right, versus the Palestinian Jews.
Okay. Right.
I just want to get the terms right, because you know, to say that you're not saying that only Arabs can be Palestinians, are you?
No.
Okay.
Fair enough.
Okay.
So, you know, the fact that you had approximately 750,000 indigenous Palestinians who were exiled from their home during the 1948 war and who were never allowed to return to their homes presents a real problem when you talk about free Jewish immigration from anywhere in the world to Israel. Now, as a condition of Israel's acceptance to the United Nations, that Israel implement UN General Assembly Resolution 194, which stipulates that refugees who either were expelled or fled from their homes in the exigencies of war are allowed to return to those properties. That was a precondition for Israel joining the United Nations almost 60 years ago, and it still hasn't been done.
Okay. Now, of course, when there was the partition plan, the Palestinians, the Arabs, rejected their state, rejected having half the state, declared war on Israel, and said things like exterminate the Jews, kill them all, massacre them all, throw them into the sea. At that time, they would have had a state that's much larger than where the West Bank and Gaza is today. That was clearly a mistake of the Arab countries not to accept that Arab state. You'd agree?
Well, I think that there were a lot of problems with the 1947 UN partition plan. By what right?
Because you don't support the existence of a Jewish state.
No, by what right does a country, but does an international body have the right to come in and to dispossess the indigenous inhabitants from a portion of their homeland?
There.
Now, the fact that the Palestinian Arabs rejected this partition plan is not surprising, because at the time of the partition, Jews owned about 8% of historic Palestine. It made up about a third
and
of the
Arabs
population.
And Arabs owned about 10%, because, as you know, 70 or 80% was owned by the government. Most of it was empty land. In fact, one of the things that most struck me today as I was traveling throughout the West Bank is how much of it still today is empty land. Gaza is very crowded, but 50 to 70% of it is uninhabited. And that's very interesting to me when talking about dividing up the land.
Right. Well, certainly, you know, no land, no matter how productive, can sustain a huge population.
But let me ask you this.
Open areas.
if the Arabs had not attacked Israel, mm-hmm. if they, for example, accepted the Peel Commission plan way back in the 1930s, Israel would have a very, very tiny existence, basically from Haifa down to a little bit of Tel Aviv, maybe 10% of what Israel exists today, much, much less. There would have been no Holocaust. 6 million Jews would have had a place to go. They would be alive today, more than enough to live in the land. The Arabs would have 90%+ of mandatory Palestine. But, of course, they didn't accept it, and they proceeded to massacre Jews in Hebron, Jerusalem, and so forth. Clearly, that was a mistake.
Well, when you talk about massacres, there were massacres committed on both sides.
No, there weren't.
Sure, there were.
No, there weren't.
For example, in April of 1948, you had the Irgun, which was a pre-state militia that belonged to the Jewish community that came into a village like Deir Yassin and massacred.
Well, if you want to talk about Deir Yassin, we can.
Massacred its inhabitants.
Well, what was happening in Deir Yassin? Let's talk about what's happening in Deir Yassin because
Hang on, let me finish.
It's a great example of misinformation. That's why I'd love to talk about Deir
Yassin. It created widespread panic amongst the indigenous Palestinian community, which caused many to flee in fear of the invading and occupying militias and later armies.
Okay, so what happened in 1948, as you know, the Jewish community of Jerusalem, Jews were the largest population in Jerusalem since for more than a century, way back into the first 1840 census. The Jordanian army comes in of what's supposed to be an international city and puts the population under siege, allows them no food, no water. The Israeli army is trying desperately to get to these Jews, to try to provide them with food and water, to try to save Jerusalem, the holy Jewish city. The people of Deir Yassin, of course, set up a roadblock, don't allow the army in, and then they put up white flags, white surrender flags. The army goes through, they start shooting. The army shoots back, and that is the great massacre at Deir Yassin. Yes, war happens, but there's a difference between war and intentional massacre of civilians. And one of the things I find really striking between the way Israel fights its wars and the way Hamas fights its wars is that Israel tries to attack the terrorists, tries to attack the people that are killing civilians, and sometimes accidentally kill civilians.
That's not any kind of...
Hamas intentionally targets civilians. Mm-hmm. Can we agree at least Hamas intentionally targets civilians?
Of course they do,
okay.
As does the Israeli army.
Never
and
does.
Thousands of civilians have been massacred by the Israeli army over the past 6 to 7 years. You can't kill thousands of people and tell me that it's an accident. That's ridiculous and preposterous.
I can't?
That's ridiculous.
Okay. So
look at any legitimate and credible human rights report from any Israeli or Palestinian or international human rights organization, and they will tell you that there are deliberate targeting of civilian areas by the Israeli army.
So you think the Lebanese army is deliberately attacking civilians right now in the refugee camp?
I don't have a good handle on what's going on in Lebanon, to be honest.
We've got 40,000 people that are trapped. They have no food and water. That's what they're claiming. I mean... should Lebanon defend itself, or should it allow terrorists to set up arms in a camp, attack its civilians, rob its banks with impunity?
I'm curious as to what your definition of terrorism is.
My definition of terrorism is intentional attacking of civilians.
Mm-hmm.
It's going after civilian targets. For example, when Yasser Arafat goes into a school in Kiryat Shmona and tries to kill all the children, or when a suicide bomber walks into a Passover Seder and explodes, or into a mall and explodes, killing himself and lots of people. I see that as very different from, say, what the United States is doing in Afghanistan, where where a country attacked us and we're responding in self-defense. And, you know, sometimes civilians are killed in war. There's no question we killed German citizens in responding to the Nazi aggression. I understand that happens in wartime. But I don't think there was an intentional campaign to murder civilians. Now, some argue Dresden was that, and we can argue about that. But in general, I think there's a difference between self-defense in war and purposely going after civilian targets.
I think it's really, to flip history on its head to say that Israel is the innocent defender in this situation. No, Israel is engaged in a brutal, 4-decades-old, illegal military occupation of the Palestinian West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. It's the aggressor. It's the one who has besieged and terrorized the Palestinian population of these areas for 4 decades now with complete U.S. Economic, diplomatic, and military support. It's our taxpayer dollars that are going to fund these human rights violations against Palestinians.
Josh, saying it does not make it so. What you'll find is that every single time Israel has given land to the Palestinians, they've used it to attack and to kill and to murder more people, whether it be Gaza or Lebanon or anywhere else. There would be Arab state in 1947 if the Arabs hadn't attacked Israel. In 1967, Jordan had the West Bank, Egypt had Gaza. There could have been a Palestinian state. Camp David in 2000, Ehud Barak and Bill Clinton offered Arafat a Palestinian state on the silver platter. They said no. Hamas, like you, wants to see the destruction of the state of Israel, and I don't think Israel should negotiate with anyone who wants to. I'll give you a chance to respond. We've got to take a break. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back after this.
History has demonstrated that violence only begets greater violence. And injustice only begets greater injustice. This is not the tradition of our great nation. This is not how we want the United States to be known around the world. We have another tradition that we think ought to prevail. One that is more just and more powerful. There is a better way. If we truly want peace and security, then we must work hard for justice.
If you're concerned that we've become a nation whose national policies are grounded in beliefs that are centered on a line embedded in BS, then don't miss Escape from Orwellianation, a talk show in which concerned regular citizens like you and me, not self-serving media spinmeisters, wade through the barrage of newspeak and doublethink that pollutes public discourse today. Big Brother, big business, big media, and the big national parties who collude to keep we the people afraid and in the dark would prefer that you not watch. Show them who's in charge. Tune in to Escape from Orwellianation right here on Channel 10.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
An inviolable palace from their home.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
See the situation in the Middle East. What are the sources of violence? Should the state of Israel even exist? Or should it cease its 60-year existence and the Jews, I'm not sure where they'd have to go. Josh, I mean, if Israel ceased to exist, what would happen to its Jewish population?
Well, I don't think that any population should be forced to move from their homes. And, you know, if you're talking about potential political solutions, the dominant discourse over the last couple decades in terms of the peace process has been establishing an independent Palestinian state side by side with Israel. That was accepted by the PLO back in 1988, and it's been the guiding principle of Land for Peace initiatives ever since 1967 and UN Security Council Resolution 242. Now,
but the current Palestinian government led by Hamas doesn't support that.
That's very true. The current Palestinian government led by Hamas has called for a truce with the state of Israel.
They've called for a hudna, which is different from a truce.
Well, that would be how most people would translate hudna from Arabic. But, you know, the question is whether or not there can be an independent and viable Palestinian state set up in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. Now, when the peace process started back in 1993 with Oslo, it specifically said that the West Bank and Gaza were to be treated as one single territorial unit. That was in the agreement between Israel and the PLO. Now, today what you have is Gaza besieged by Israel, by land, by sea, by air, completely cut off from not only the West Bank, but also from the entire world. And in the West Bank, as you mentioned before, you have a wall that's being built deep within Palestinian territory that the International Court of Justice declared to be illegal in 2004 because an occupier can't change the demographics of a land that's under occupation. And the West Bank has been cut up into so many different little pieces by walls, by Israeli settlements, by Israeli army bases, that having a really viable and contiguous state made up of the West Bank and Gaza is seeming like more and more of a pipe dream. So as long as Israel continues to maintain its illegal military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, it's really creating the conditions that will make it impossible for there to be an independent Palestinian state set up.
To be clear, I certainly think it's laughable to call it illegal. The International Court of Justice is hardly a court. It is controlled by the General Assembly, which, of course, is a number of dictators, a number of nations, all of whom want Arab oil. One of the first things I learned in my international law class was there is no international law. The only international law that exists is the Security Council, and the Security Council has not said the occupation is illegal in any binding way. But to get to the point of where Israel is, most Israelis, and I think you'd agree with me on this, they don't want to control over Arabs. They don't want to rule over Palestinian Arabs. They would like to release it. In fact, the Israeli elections, they elected a party, Kadima, that was committed to withdrawing from the territories. They withdrew entirely from Gaza. And I remember I had a debate on this very show when that happened. And I was arguing with someone who said, if the Israelis withdraw from Gaza, the Palestinian terrorists will come in, they'll use it as a base to attack Israeli cities, they're forcibly removing Jewish people who are living there. That's wrong, that's racist, they shouldn't do it. And I disagreed at that time. I said, I think Israel should leave Gaza. This is a great chance to test the Palestinians. If they take Gaza and they make a peaceful state out of it, then Israel will be ready to leave broad portions of the West Bank, and they will show that they can live in peace, that they're not out to destroy Israel, they're out to live in peace with Israel. Unfortunately, I guess I was wrong, because what have they done? They've taken Gaza, they've claimed that, oh, this is because of our terrorism that we won Gaza, and now they're attacking, sending missiles, hundreds of missiles, into Israeli towns and villages, basically begging the Israeli army to come back in. Was it a mistake for Israel to leave Gaza?
No, I don't think it was a mistake for Israel to leave Gaza. It was obligated to leave Gaza because you cannot acquire territory through the use of force, which is how Israel acquired the Gaza Strip and the West Bank.
You can't acquire territory through use of force. So our acquiring of California was illegal. France acquiring of Alsace-Lorraine, Polish controlling Eastern German lands, all of that's illegal. We need to give California back to the Mexicans.
Well, a lot of what you're referring to is it predates the establishment of the UN and the development of international institutions that are supposed to mandate some types of breaks on how warfare is conducted so as to promote human rights across the world. Now, you asked me about what Israel should have done in Gaza. That's very significant, I think, that Israel decided to unilaterally withdraw from the Gaza Strip back in August 2005. Now, this dates back at least to 2001, when the then Prime Minister Ariel Sharon jettisoned the peace process and said, we're not interested in negotiations, we're not interested in picking up where the previous government had left off, we're going to decide what we're going to do unilaterally. So yes, Israel did withdraw from the Gaza Strip, but it did so in a way that there was absolutely no security coordination with the Palestinian Authority. So it's not at all surprising, I think, that you have a very anarchic situation right now in the Gaza Strip. And also, let's not forget that for all these missiles that you referred to, Israel has killed hundreds of Palestinian civilians in the Gaza Strip, especially last year during its very brutal war on the Gaza Strip.
What they've done is they've responded to missiles attacking. I mean, let's face it, we killed, you know, millions, thousands of German civilians, and we killed hundreds of thousands of Japanese in Hiroshima in response to attacks on us. One of the things that I find shocking is when you say Sharon left and he didn't negotiate a peace. As you know, the Palestinians refused to negotiate a peace. There was Camp David, and they were offered 92%, some say 97%, but a contiguous territory on a silver platter. There was even going to be, Ehud Barak said, a roadway that was going to be above the ground so they could travel from the West Bank to Gaza, completely contiguous territory. Arafat kept saying, give me more, give me more, give me more. He refused to make a single concession. This is from Dennis Ross, from Bill Clinton, from people that, you know, were in the middle. This isn't from the Israeli sources. And finally, Israel said, you know what? You're never going to negotiate with us. We understand you only want war, which, after all, that's what Arafat was saying. I refuse to give an inch. What I want you to do is give me a position, and then we'll start there and then negotiate against yourself. Clinton said Arafat wasn't serious about peace. So Sharon went one better. He said, I don't care whether you negotiate with me or not. Here, take the land. And what did the Palestinians do? They amassed arms and used that land to try to kill Israeli civilians. Let me suggest to you that there's an easy way out of this, a really easy way out of this. The easy way is for the Palestinians to have a leader like Gandhi or Martin Luther King who understands nonviolence and says, you know what? We will say that we will accept your right to exist. We believe in a two-state solution, and we won't attack you from Gaza. Now let's talk about withdrawing from the West Bank. But Hamas instead is again and again saying destroy the state of Israel. The Hudna that you mentioned, as you well know, but our listeners may not know, he used a reference to a Hudna, a truce that the Prophet Muhammad did. But that truce, what Muhammad did is he waited, he lay low until he was more powerful than his non-Muslim enemies, and then he attacked. And so Hudna with a wink, so Hamas with a wink and a nod is saying, we're going to lay low until we build up more weapons. Every time Israel leaves, when they leave Lebanon, Hezbollah attacks. It seems to me the message to Israel is clear. If you leave territory, you're going to be attacked.
So what's your proposal, that Israel maintain its illegal military occupation forever?
It's not
forever?
Illegal in my view. In my view, what Israel needs to do is wait for a Palestinian peaceful leader to emerge. Mm. And if it has to wait 50 years, and if it has to wait 300 years, it just has to wait. Most Israelis, like me, don't want to be there doing the occupation. But what's interesting, I was in Israel just 2 months ago, and I was talking with people from far-right Likud to far-left Meretz party, and it was interesting to me what the far-left said, because they were against the security wall. But they had to admit to me that the terrorist attacks have gone way down, from hundreds of civilians murdered a year to virtually none. The wall protects Israeli citizens. We may disagree on where the wall should go, but at least the existence of a wall protects the Israeli citizens. So I don't know how you can be against at least the existence of a wall.
Well, I don't have any problem if Israel decides that it wants to build a wall to protect itself as a garrison state from now until, you know, the next incarnation of this universe, if it builds it on its own territory.
What do you consider Israeli territory?
But what Israel did was build this wall deep inside Palestinian territories in occupied lands, land that Israel has occupied for now four decades. Now, you said that this military occupation is not illegal. Dozens of Security Council resolutions requiring Israel to withdraw from these territories would say otherwise.
In exchange
and
for
the
peace.
And the fact that Israel has engaged in a brutal occupation that has killed thousands of civilians over the past four decades. I mean, I think when you talk about Israeli civilians being targeted, I sympathize with you. Israeli civilians should not be targeted, not by Hamas, not by Hezbollah, not by any organization. Civilians are sacrosanct in terms of not being the target of military operations. Now, if I'm going to stake out that position, you've got to meet me halfway, and you've got to recognize the fact that Israel has killed thousands of innocent Palestinian civilians in the course of this military occupation.
And I blame the terrorists for it, because it seems to me that if you're a terrorist and you surround yourself with children and you take 6-year-olds and 10-year-olds and put them all around you and then shoot out and kill other children, and a bomb comes back and hits you and kills the children, whose fault is it? My view is the kidnapper's fault, not Israel's fault. If you want to join the discussion, you can do so, 888-48-MARK, right back after this.
I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God.
My name is David Bell. I am a resident of Virginia's 11th Congressional District, and I ask Representative Tom Davis to initiate or support investigations into violations of the law by President Bush and his administration.
Tom Davis, my name is Jean Reynolds, and I'm one of your constituents. I want you to join immediately with other members of Congress to begin an investigation of the criminal acts that George Bush has committed.
I'm Nick Spengler of Assam, Virginia, and I would like our troops to come home and Bush to get out of office.
My name is Nancy Maynard. I live in the 11th Congressional District, and this message is for Tom Davis. I'm asking you to please investigate for impeachment.
My name is Bruce Smith. I live in the 11th Congressional District in Woodbridge, Virginia. I want Congressman Davis to support the investigation of President Bush and Vice President Cheney and those that foisted this war on us.
Hello, Congressman Davis. I'm Carrie Plonson from the 11th Congressional District, and I'd like you to take immediate action to investigate George Bush and his offenses in leading this country into a war that's unwarranted and there is no solution for.
We have to impeach. I am just appalled that we would not, quote, waste our time with impeachment. The message to the world has to be that Bush and Cheney are guilty of international war crimes about which we can't do anything. We can do a lot about the crimes committed within the U.S. Constitution.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm discussing the situation in the Middle East with Josh Rubner. He is the grassroots advocacy coordinator with the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. We've been having it fast and furious, but you're welcome to join in the debate. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. You know, when you have states and you have peoples that don't get along, whether it's Bosnia or Iraq or anyone else, it seems that a partition is the obvious solution. It's not a great solution, but the obvious one. When Pakistan and India came out of the British mandate, at that time you had tens of millions of Muslims leave their homes in India to go to Pakistan, tens of millions of Hindus leave their homes in Pakistan to go to India. You've seen these population transfers. The Volksdeutsche in Germany left when Poland took East Germany. Germany still gives preference to citizens of German extraction, actually. Gets them have preference into their country under like a law of return. And, of course, in Israel's case, I dispute your figure of 750,000. My understanding is the figure is 590,000. But certainly a significant number, 600,000 to 700,000 Arabs left what became the Jewish state. At the same time, as you know, 800,000 Jews were forced to leave Arab countries. Some 200,000 went to France and other countries. 600,000 went to Israel. Approximately the same number of Jews had to leave Arab countries as Arabs that left the new state of Israel. Israel made all of those Jews full citizens of the Jewish state. The Arab countries did not. And interestingly, still in Lebanon today, there's 40,000 Palestinian Arabs who have no citizenship, no rights to vote in Lebanon, and are attacking the Lebanese government as we speak. Are the Arabs wrong not to give Palestinian citizenship in their country?
Well, in some cases, they do have citizenship.
Jordan would be the one
example. In Jordan, where the largest Palestinian refugee population resides. But I think it would be a mistake to say that because there was a roughly equivalent transfer of Palestinians from what became Israel vis-a-vis Jewish immigration from Arab countries, these are not collective rights. These are individual rights. So the fact that you had these population transfers doesn't cancel out people's right to compensation. It doesn't cancel out their right to return to their properties where that's feasible and where that's a precondition of Israel's acceptance into the UN. So, yes, I grant you that there was this population transfer in the Middle East in post-World War II, but that doesn't cancel out people's individual human rights.
Well, now it's been 60 years since 1948. Very few of those original refugees are still alive. The UN does something with Palestinians it does with no other refugee in history. It says that the children, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren are still refugees. It doesn't do that with other refugees, interestingly enough. Only the United Nations does that. And I wonder, you know, unless you're saying that the Jews of Israel need to go back to Germany and Poland and
the
Indians and Pakistanis need to switch, it's clearly, maybe we could tally up all the Jewish losses from the Arab countries and all the Arab losses from Israel, add a total number, and then do reparations back and forth. I'd support that. Would you support that?
I think that that could be part of the resolution to the issue. But you ask a pertinent question here, and that is the fact that you have two competing nationalisms over the same piece of territory, which has always been the gist of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Now, I believe that both Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs have individual human rights and collective national rights to self-determination in that land. So
that sounds like you do support a Jewish state, then.
Well, the question is it going to be a just resolution to have Israel dominant and sovereign over 100% of historic Palestine, which is a situation that you have today, and is a situation where some people, Jewish Israelis, have their full human rights, and you have a situation where Palestinians are denied their right to freedom, their right to statehood, their right to self-determination, their right to live in peace and security. All of these things are denied to Palestinians because of Israel's military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and because Israel refuses to allow Palestinians back to their original homeland. So what I would prefer to see, speaking in a personal capacity, is a situation where both Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs can exercise their full human and national rights in their historic homelands, and not try to judge who has a better claim to the land. That's never going to be settled.
I would agree with you.
But let's have a situation.
I would agree with you that that's the way it goes.
Exactly.
But so let's have a situation. There's a reason why the Palestinian Arabs aren't living in freedom. It's because every single time they've been offered a state, they have used what they've got in order to try to attack and murder and massacre and commit genocide on the Jews. Whether you talk about 1929, 1939, 1947, 1967, or even in 2000, and we don't have to go into ancient history, where Yasser Arafat was offered, some say 92%, some say 97%, a contiguous piece of land, including even the Temple Mount, the holiest place to the Jews ever, was going to be given to the Palestinians, and he said no. And I would venture to you that you can't give a state to a people who doesn't want a state, that is more interested in violence. I do want to get to the phone calls, though. Ian from Fairfax, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you. I've just got a real quick question. How long do you think this will be going on?
I would say decades, if not longer, in my view. I don't know. Do you have a view on this?
Well, I think on that we agree, because I think the fundamental problem is that the state of Israel has never come to terms with the fact that Palestinians have individual and collective human rights. Now, you talk about Palestinians rejecting every opportunity. Now, these offers that were made, would they have resulted in an independent and viable Palestinian state? Now, I don't know of anyone who argues that what was offered at Camp David was a contiguous piece of land.
I don't know anyone that argues that it wasn't.
If you look at the maps, there were three very clear different cantons that would be
surrounded. Are you calling Dennis Ross and Bill Clinton a liar?
I'm not calling anyone a liar.
Well, Dennis Ross and Bill Clinton said it was contiguous.
I'm saying according to the maps that were put out, these clumps of land were bisected by Israeli access roads, Israeli settlement blocks, etc.
Okay, Josh, that's not true. Now, I don't know whether you don't know.
I know.
True,
I know.
But
I worked for the U.S. government at the time, and I followed the negotiations very closely.
But you're talking about the first Israeli offer. You're not talking about what Israel finally agreed to at the end, are you?
I think it's very interesting that you always cut the narrative off at Camp David and neglect the fact that after Camp David, let me just back up a second and say that before Camp David started, there was absolutely no preparatory work. There were no serious negotiations on the so-called final status issues between Israelis and Palestinians for more than 2 years. Now, Ehud Barak, who was the prime minister, said, I want a summit. I want to nail this down. Yasser Arafat, who is the Palestinian president, said, we're too far apart at this point to go into a summit. Let's have low-level negotiations so that we can hammer it out. Because let's face it, summits are, to a large extent, photo ops. Now, he said to President Clinton, and you can go back and look this up in Israeli and Palestinian press, he said, I'll come on one condition, and that is if the talks break down, no one will be assigned blame for their failure, because I don't think we're ready to go to summit. Now, what's the first thing that President Clinton did? Not 15 minutes after the talks broke down, he blamed Yasser Arafat 100% for the breakdown of
these
talks.
Because he was 100% at fault.
But now after...
Why didn't he give a counterproposal?
After, he wasn't allowed to give a counterproposal. This was an Israeli and an American dictate to Palestinians, and Barak presented
it
as
a
take it to... Take it or leave it.
Now, why couldn't he give a counterproposal?
What I mentioned at the outset of this was that I think it's very convenient that you cut off the narrative at Camp David, because months after Camp David, Israeli and Palestinian negotiators went back to the table at Taba in Egypt without U.S. participation. And I think that's the key, because the United States tries to present itself as an honest broker, but the fact is we give Israel billions of dollars of economic and military support every year, and under international law, when you're providing that type of support to a side in a conflict, you've in essence declared that you're on their side. So the idea that the United States could be some type of honest broker is ridiculous.
Well, then let's have no broker. We'll have Israel and Arabs, and they'll just stay where they are, and they'll have their security wall. Listen, you know as well as I do that the United States is the only one that can force Israel to do anything. And that's why the Arabs want the U.S. at the table. But what I find fascinating is that basically you're saying that Dennis Ross and Bill Clinton are lying when they say that they presented proposal after proposal after proposal, contiguous land, which I'll show a map on after the break, and Arafat refused to give a counterproposal.
What I began to say and what I'd like to finish is that the fact is that the proposals that were made at Camp David were improved upon from the Palestinian perspective at Taba. Now, at the end of the Taba negotiating round back in early 2001, Israeli and Palestinian negotiators released a statement saying that we've never been closer to achieving a resolution of this conflict than we are today, and we're convinced that we can get that agreement with more negotiations. Now, this was a bit of a lame duck negotiating session because, as you'll remember back, Ehud Barak was in the process of losing the election to Ariel Sharon.
Sure.
Now, as I mentioned also before, Ariel Sharon came into power and said whatever was discussed at Taba is off the table.
Right.
Whatever was discussed at Camp David is off the table. Palestinians can take 42% of the West Bank, which is roughly the autonomous areas that the Palestinian Authority had.
They really missed an opportunity, didn't they? When
well,
they had 97% on the table and they said no. Tell me this. What counterproposal, what concessions did Arafat ever make? At any time, Camp David, Taba, what concessions did they make?
Well, let's start with the biggest concession of them all. And that was signing the letter of the letter of recognition of the State of Israel, which preceded.
About back in 1993.
Yes, which preceded the signing of the Oslo Accord.
At which point Israel
now,
allowed them all out of exile in Tunis and allowed tens of thousands of armed Palestinian fighters back into the lands and took an intifada that was mostly done with stones and changed it, frankly, to one that was done with explosives. So Israel definitely lost hundreds of lives because of this.
So you're the type of person who doesn't agree that there should have been a peace process to start with.
No, I support a peace
PLO,
process,
right?
But the PLO said that they would end the violence. And they didn't. And it seems to me that it's one thing to sit down. I find it shocking that Yasser Arafat was offered 88%, and he said, I'm not going to give you the slightest bit of counterproposal. So Israel offers him 92%. He says, no deal, not even a discussion. They offer him 96%. I'm not even interested. I'm not going to talk to you, and don't blame me. So they offer him 97%, and he says, well, we're close, but there's an election. I don't blame the Israeli public for throwing away Barak. I would never hire a lawyer that was negotiating with the other side and made an offer. If I made an offer on a home, and I said, you know, I'll give you $200,000, and the person says, no, I want $500, and I offer them $400, they say, I want $500, and I offer them $499, and they want $500, then I say, you know what? You're not negotiating with me, are you? This isn't a give and take. You just want me to give. And that's exactly... So what happens? They leave Gaza. They completely leave it. It's open. And then they attack from Gaza. That, to me, is not negotiation in good faith. I do want to get to our callers.
Okay, fair enough.
Let's go to Samira from Reston. Samira, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
I am just shocked at your ideas. You're just repeating the distortion of the truth about the peace offers from Israel to the Palestinians. Palestinians want peace as much as any other nation as a human being. It's Israel that doesn't want peace. Israel is an expansionist agenda. It plans to take the whole West Bank. They never have a plan to get out of Palestine. Their plan is to expand. Just as prove it is by building settlement inside Israel. And your idea that Palestinians always refuse to sign peace agreement. Palestinians were never given a decent peace agreement. The so-called peace offers from Israel never gave them a control of their air, their water, their borders. They were just offering them a big prison controlled by Israel. They were never giving them
Samira,
any offers.
In 1947, they had a chance and they refused, right?
How can you accept that offer in 1947?
Okay.
If somebody comes to your house and tells you, my God said I should take your house because my God
promised
you your house.
No one said anyone should take anyone's house.
That
they didn't have to leave.
That's what Israel did. It took Palestinians' land.
They didn't have to leave. They would have to live
would you
as a minority
accept that
under
offer,
Jewish
would
sovereignty.
You, if somebody comes and takes your house, you will refuse
it's
that
it,
offer.
It's
they
not
came
a question
and
of taking
took
house.
The Palestinian land.
Samira, in 1967, Jordan had the entire West Bank and all of East Jerusalem, including the Temple Mount. Egypt had all of Gaza. Should Jordan and Egypt have created a Palestinian state then?
What do you mean?
They had all of it. They had every square inch of it, and instead Jordan attacked Israel. Well, I mean, don't you think that if the Arabs cared about the Palestinians, they would have created a Palestinian state in the 19 years they controlled the land?
You are mixing apples and oranges. You are just trying to defend the right of Israel to take Palestine, which is they have never an intention to give Palestine to the Palestinian people. They have an expansionist agenda.
The Arabs had the land, and instead of living peacefully on it, they attacked. The same is true of Gaza.
It's Israel that attacked. What happened in 67, you are just promoting the...
Jordan attacked Israel in 1967. Are you denying that?
No, I deny that. Israel instigated that attack.
Josh, you're not denying that Jordan started the war in 1967 against Israel, are you?
No, it was instigated by Israel.
Thank you for your call, Samir. I appreciate it. Josh, let's get a little history straight. You're not denying that King Hussein started the war in 1967.
As most historians would agree, the first shots were fired when Israel destroyed the Egyptian Air Force on the first day of that war. So,
Egypt closes.
No, Jordan did not start it.
Egypt orders the United Nations to leave in violation of international law. They close the Straits of Tehran to international shipping, an internationally recognized act of war. They start mobilizing their troops. Okay? When Israel attacks the Egyptian Air Force, they beg King Hussein of Jordan to stay out of it. And what does he do? He fires the first shots. We can agree on this history. Right?
I think that that's a more or less accurate rundown of events. But the point that's important here is not who started what, who fired the first shot. It's the situation that exists on the ground today. And Palestinians are living in deplorable conditions as a direct result of policies enacted and created by the State of Israel. Now, you have reports coming out that upwards of 50% of people in the Gaza Strip are malnourished because of the siege.
Civil war.
It's not because of the civil war. Listen, Mark, it's because of the fact that Israel has imposed and continues to impose a sea, a land, and an air siege on the Gaza Strip. Now, produce,
what do you think would happen produce if the Gaza Strip stopped attacking Israel?
Produce from Gaza cannot leave. Trade into Gaza cannot come in without Israel's permission. Now, to say that Israel has left the Gaza Strip, that the people of Gaza are free to do whatever they want, to exercise self-determination, that's a joke. Israel controls every aspect of their movement, of their lives, and of their ability to continue to live in that area.
If Gaza stopped raiding missiles on Israel, what do you think would happen?
But you know, let's be balanced on this. If you're saying that Gazans should not shoot into civilian targets in Israel, it's got to be the same in the reverse. Israel has got to stop its belligerent shelling of
the
Gaza Strip.
They took
as I mentioned before, Mark, those people were living there illegally. Those people were living there illegally under international law, under the Geneva Conventions. As you know, it's a war crime. It is a war crime to move your civilian population into the conquered and occupied territories that are under your control.
When it kicked the Jews out of Jerusalem, Jordan
committed a war crime. Absolutely. That type of ethnic cleansing is not permissible under international law. So let's be balanced. Now, you want me to condemn every bad act that any Arab or Muslim has ever done, yet you create excuses and justifications for Israel's much more stronger and systematic brutality against the Palestinian people. Why can't you condemn some of those acts?
I think you'll find that Israel has responded far less aggressively to the terrorist acts from the Palestinians than Lebanon has, than Jordan did.
This is ridiculous.
Than Syria
last
did.
Summer, Israel destroyed Gaza's scale civil disobedience and acts of nonviolence against Israel's military occupation to demonstrate that it's wrong on a moral level. Now, what happens when you have international, Israeli, and Palestinian...
The American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it. So call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! All right. Friday then, Tuesday, not Monday, right? Yeah. So it's going to be one of those weird short weeks. But it was a short week last week, and I've been gone since Wednesday, and I've been sort of howling to get back to the back behind the microphone just because of everything that's been going on. I'm tempted at the outset of this program to deliver a patented, trademarked, otherwise guaranteed, blistering assault on what passes for my political party. I won't. Everybody else already's done it. There's no need to for me to.